It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Basically, what we're gonna do is dance. Basically, what we're gonna do is dance.
The chokehold that Vanessa Hudgens Sneaker Night song has over Hannah is shocking.
But also not, because I literally don't know what the lyric is after that.
Sneaker night.
Yeah, sneaker night.
Kind of in a similar way to Bridget Mendler, I feel like Vanessa Hudgens was making a lot of like R&B style songs back in the day.
Yeah, she actually had a few that I did genuinely like love.
Oh, some absolute bangers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Baby, come back to me.
Yeah, great song.
Great song.
Her voice can only go so far, though. Like, I think it has its limits.
Yes. But also, like, Vanessa Hudgens, I love the girl, and I need her to ascend to A-list status pronto.
To be honest, I don't. After the whole pandemic fiasco, where she said,
yeah, people are gonna die.
But, like, Coachella should still happen.
Look, she's the queen of Coachella, okay? If she's not gonna stand up for Coachella, who the fuck is?
Who the hell will? Yeah, she's actually doing God's work.
She is.
She did make those amazing Christmas movies.
Oh my god, all three of them. And she played so many people. Like, where's her Oscar? Why are we applauding Austin Butler for doing an Elvis impression when Vanessa Hudgens played three people in one movie and no one talks about it?
Oh yeah, that movie. I forgot about that. I mean, Hilary Duff did walk so she could run.
Okay, Hilary Duff played two characters.
Sing for me, Paolo.
Sing for me, Paolo.
So on Twitter, this guy posted this thing that went really viral, as happens on Twitter. He was like, do you know what a bottle night is? Probably not, because my girlfriend and I invented it during a 2023 blizzard in Buffalo, New York. We lock our phones away, turn the TV off, each grab a bottle of wine, and talk. That's it. We simply talk and enjoy each other's presence. We live together, but it's easy to miss out on quality time. What do you think? Do you have other methods for enjoying quality time with your partner? And it blew up, and the entire internet is basically ratioing him and making fun of him. So I just wanted to chat about that.
Okay, I think it's weird that people are so, like, annoyed about it, because I just think it's an obnoxious post, but ultimately it's like, okay, whatever. These people are having a night in and drinking wine and they feel good about themselves.
This guy has 3,000 followers. Like, I don't think he was posting thinking that he was saying this to the world. Is he insufferable? Yes. Going to his page, you're like, oh, you are annoying, but...
But you know what? He sounds like he's like a hustle culture kind of guy, and at least he's finding time to drink an entire bottle of wine next to his girlfriend.
It's so funny that this one tweet was like, we did it. We gentrified alcoholism, which I actually am banning that word, and I'm the one who hates when people ban words. I'm banning gentrification.
Alcoholism?
Gentrification.
Oh.
You may no longer call yourself alcoholic. Oh my god, this person said, here's what you would look like if you were... Oh my god. This person said, here's what you would look like if you were black or Chinese. And they just AI photoshopped the image to make them different races. And this tweet has so many likes. And I don't understand.
I don't know. Sometimes you need to close Twitter.
There are two camps. Like, there are people who are saying that he's trying to normalize alcoholism, which, yes, I do think is really funny that they are each drinking a bottle of wine. And in the photo, he's chugging it from the bottle.
But how often do they do it?
Once a week.
Oh, once a week is a lot to be drinking an entire bottle of wine, but like once a month?
Actually, sorry, I don't know if it's once a week. I just think it's funny because he's trying to make it seem like he invented what you should essentially be doing with your partner anyways. Like, oh, I just would like to know what the two of them are doing when they're not doing bottle night. Like, is there an issue that they're both on their phones nonstop?
Well, maybe it's like they are both hustling and grinding so hard that they kind of have to
schedule time to sit down.
But they have to drink an entire bottle of wine and kind of like maximize the experience because it's supposed to then keep them going.
They are kind of hustling, hanging out.
Yeah. And as they should. Hack your life.
Hack your life. All the power to you, Colin Rutherford and girlfriend. I'm Aya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is a loose, no pun intended, history of sex on the internet, the symbiosis of humanity's two most basic instincts, innovation and getting off. If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. And if you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, please. So back in 2015, in the early years of smartphone dating apps, there were a whole bunch of studies and think pieces predicting that young people would have twice as many sexual partners as their parents. And yet, over the past few years or so, they're actually finding that young people are having far less sex than their parents.
What?
And in this episode, we're going to be thinking about why dating apps may be the cause of that. The question that's overarching our discussion today is, how have dating apps changed the culture of sex and intimacy? Hannah, like anyone else, you've had experience with dating apps.
Yes.
Tell us about your feelings about them.
I hate them. I hate them for a number of reasons. I hate them for like kind of larger, widespread cultural reasons, but I also hate them because I'm bad at using them. I don't like to text. I don't get excited about seeing a person's pictures. It does nothing for me. I'm not like, wow, I can't wait to meet this person from my phone in real life. I hate the idea of that. I hate the idea of meeting someone for the first time on a date. Like, it does not work for me as a model. And I think that they are like ruining our ability to meet one another in real life. So all in all, not a fan.
I think that's fair. Is there a reason you keep using them?
Because I literally feel like there's no choice. I keep trying to not use them. And I think that our generation doesn't know how to date without the assistance of dating apps right now. Or like they've impacted our ability to, and it kind of feels like the only option to meet new people.
I think that's a great point. I too have historically used dating apps. Right now I'm on a detox because I just don't have it in me to talk to a rando. I just don't feel like it. I want to be into someone before I talk to them. I don't want to, like, before I have a romantic spark with them. It takes a lot of energy, honestly, to get on the apps these days. Like, you really have to get into it. And then you look through your Hinge likes and you're like, oh.
Well, because it's like, yeah, the time you're going to be going through a dating app is like, you have to actually dedicate that time to it because it's kind of all consuming. But I'm like, what? I'm just going to sit in my room and be on this like app? That makes me feel really sad.
I think you have to dedicate time to it when you're looking for someone special. I think that's the key difference there. So I just want to start the episode with a brief history. Shocker. Believe it or not, online dating has been around for a fairly long time. The whole idea of dating apps is basically to use technology as a sort of middleman between yourself and your potential lover or soulmate. And one of the earliest iterations of this was back in 1976 with this company called Great Expectations, which was created by this like eccentric freak named Jeffrey Ullman. There had been questionnaire-based dating services before this where like you'd fill out answers about yourself and then be matched up by a third-party company with someone who answers similarly to yourself. But Great Expectations streamlined this questionnaire process with videotape. So you'd answer questions on video and then you'd watch videos of your potential matches also answering questions.
I've heard of video dating, yeah.
And then you'd select the person based on who you're interested in. And what's interesting about it is that Ullman really emphasized selling points that have more or less become staples of the dating app industry. Like, he preached the concept of self-improvement. He talked about how IRL dating was a waste of time and how great expectations would cut that time down for you. He talked about how instead of seeing one partner at a time, you could screen as many as you wanted to all at once. When he was asked whether he was preying on lonely people, he said, quote, "Yes, just like restaurants prey on the hungry, and doctors prey on the sick, and talk show hosts prey on the people who are too bored to read a book." And most interesting of all, for him, Great Expectations wasn't about casual sex. It was specifically about finding a route to marriage.
Right.
Do you see any early issues with the way that he's talking about romance and intimacy?
Well, yeah, it's so calculated. And I hate that. I don't like math. But yeah, I think it's okay for people to have expectations and standards to an extent of what they want out of a relationship, right? You can have things that are like deal breakers, all of that. But ultimately, like, you can't shop for a partner the way you shop for like a house or like, you know, a car. You, like, I just don't think that that's how romance or love works. And I think like watching somebody or like reading questionnaires and just pretending that you can get a sense of what is something that really comes down to chemistry based off of those things is a dumb thing that was invented by nerds.
Totally. And I think the way that you develop chemistry is through a courting process, which I think, you know, his whole emphasis on this idea of wasting time, that really stunts the courting process. It basically turns, like you're saying, dating into a science rather than something that's so ephemeral.
It treats marriage like something you should be on a conveyor belt for a little bit.
Totally,
like,
yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, and like dating is inherently risky, but he's basically taking the risk out of it. And he's framing that as a good thing, which a lot of people initially would believe is a good thing. Why would I want to put myself out there and get hurt when I can just streamline the process and find the perfect person right away? I also think like likening it to restaurants and talk show hosts, like in doing that, he's basically creating a market out of something so fundamentally human, selling something to people that's already within them.
Yes, it's like one of the few things that we have that should be free from the grasp of capitalism is our capacity to love one another. And so exactly. Having that somehow monetized is really dystopian.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. So true. And yeah, then there's the idea of screening, you know, talking to multiple people at once. In a way, like, that is great, but then dating many people at once can also kind of keep you at a surface-level interaction. Like, you're not focusing on one person. So Great Expectations was a pretty big deal at the time, but it very quickly faded into obscurity. And then almost a decade later, in 1984, this company called Matchmaker popped up, which was this electronic pen pal network. And then coming out of that tradition in the 90s and very early 2000s was Match.com, OkCupid, and eHarmony.
Right.
Which were predicated on this idea that their computer service has a soulmate out there waiting for you. These ones operate in a similar pen pal format where you would answer questions about yourself and then have the opportunity to chat with people who were compatible to you. And the big draw of these companies was that unlike older dating services, you could use these from the privacy of your own home. So you were a bit more free with what you were able to say. Be a bit more yourself, I guess.
Right.
Or not yourself, who knows. There are some key differences between a site like Match.com and one like eHarmony. Match.com was made to be more affordable than phone dating services, and it began out of a series of web pages that hosted classifieds. Like, exactly. Jobs.com.
Callback.
Callback. Jobs.com, Houses.com, and even Sex.com were all owned by the same guy who created Match.com. And basically, Match.com's MO was to try and get as many people on there as possible, like regardless of who they were. eHarmony, on the other hand, was created by a theology professor and was sparked from his feelings about his parents having stayed together for so long despite being deeply incompatible. So it's also well-intentioned.
Right.
The thing with this one is that it coded really conservative limits into the app, not well-intentioned, like stopping taller women from dating shorter men. Like, you were not allowed to match with them.
Because God would not want that.
No, God created man and he said, shorties, you're lost.
God said, no short kings. It's in the Bible.
He also disallowed same-sex couples, and eHarmony also banned divorcees altogether. Well, which is crazy.
No, when you're divorced, your life is over and you really should give up.
You do wither away, but it really is sectioning off, like,
well, if you're
it really is abandoning a huge portion of your dating base.
If you're, like, you know, targeting older demographics who would probably benefit from being on, like, a dating website More than younger people because they're just not meeting as many single people.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, a huge portion of your dating base.
Yeah, divorcees.
I think that was a lot of the earlier demographics that were using these platforms. Like, yeah. I think now we think of dating apps as being used by young people, but back in the day, they were very much for adults.
No, for sure. Yeah. I think there was, like, a big stigma of, like, if you're on a dating app, then you're, like, probably getting older or are older and you still haven't found anybody and it's like a last resort kind of thing.
Or you're a divorcee and you're looking for a second chance.
Unless you want to go on eHarmony.
Yeah, can't go on eHarmony. It's funny because I got a lot of this information from the Samantha Cole book that I mentioned last episode, and she mentions multiple times that a lot of the founders of these early online dating companies either lost their partners to their own service or we're just unlucky in love in general.
Whoa. Okay, so those who can't exploit the fears of others.
Teach. Profit. Or something. Those who can't do teach except teach others to also not find love.
Well, yes.
She also says that between 2000 and 2010, at least 18 new dating sites were launched and that each of them purported to solve your dating problems. Cole says that when smartphones came out, they changed the game for online dating because of a very important tech innovation with the smartphone that we'll get into. Want to guess what the innovation might be?
Locations?
Yes. Okay. The GPS.
The GPS. I'm a woman in STEM.
You are. So now it's 2009 and we get the first major smartphone dating app. Want to take a stab at what that is?
Grindr?
Yes! You're so smart.
I know.
So Grindr was created by this guy named Joel Simkai, and it came onto the scene proclaiming itself to be the biggest mobile network of guys, meaning that it's mainly used by cis gay men and trans mask men.
Okay.
Simkai's whole thing was that the biggest problem men were facing in meeting other men is that there was a lack of access to each other. Mm-hmm. So for him, Grindr created this efficient GPS technology, which would find men in close range to you. And going back to Jeffrey Ullman, there's this idea of wasted time coming back again, with Grindr kind of espousing the idea that its technology expedited the process of meeting. This guy, Jamie Wu, who wrote a book about Grindr, describes it as working to bring down the investment. Could you imagine how this may have influenced the kinds of apps that are popping up today, like Raya or that insane one, The League?
Those ones are interesting because they've somehow, like, managed to incorporate the idea of networking into the existence of those apps. You can kind of see how, over time, our obsession with, like, streamlining everything has sort of cultivated in us trying to, like, fit almost, like, multiple functions into a single app, where it's, like, we are just getting more and more hyper-specific about what we're looking for dating, but we're also just trying to be productive almost in our dating life, which, guys, productivity culture is so annoying.
Just chill out.
Chill out.
Look, you only live once.
We're joking, but genuinely chill out.
Yeah, take a chill pill. Yeah, I think going back to that networking thing you mentioned, I feel like this language of, like, self-improvement, expediting, investment really treats dating like a business. And especially just these days where Raya, it just feels like they let whoever the fuck on there.
Me.
And me.
Literally me. Why? Yeah.
It's really just become an industry-based app at this point.
Yeah.
And it just feels like when you're on it, you're dating people based on their job. Like, their job description is right below their name. Yeah. Like, it's all about that. The League is even more shameless about it. If you guys don't know what The League is, it's this, like, insane networking app that's also a dating app, and it had these insane ads all over the New York subway. One of them was like, there's nothing wrong with being a gold digger. And I wish I could remember the others, because some of them were absolutely, like, heinous.
Yeah, they were crazy, and they were kind of vague in this way where it wasn't even really clear what they were selling.
Yeah, and my friend tried to make an account, and it said that one of the things was that it was like $1,000 a month for a subscription. Like,
Raya is already too fucking expensive. What loser? There must be 5 people on The League.
Raya is a scam. You pay like $30 a month to have like 6 swipes a day.
Yeah.
All these platforms now are doing these things where you have to upgrade to be able to use it properly. It's insane.
And I did not match with Deadmau5 on Raya because, yes, rude. I swipe right for anyone famous.
Oh, as do I. As do I. I did not match with Lakeith Stanfield, and it's one of the greatest L's I've ever taken.
Yeah, you should be embarrassed.
Have you felt like this businessifying of dating has impacted the nature of like the dates you've gone on or just like the dating culture that you've witnessed in general?
I will say that in my personal experiences, not so much because like business, I am bad at doing dating apps in a way that would be efficient or productive or like nice for me because I'm truly bad at using them and I go on weird dates. Just dates where I'm like, I don't have anything in common with this person, but I really hate spending time on dating apps. So
Hannah has a really bad screening process.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, you asked me out. Okay, sure.
Yeah, we had a thing where she was like, how long do you talk to someone before you go on a first date? And I was like, well, I chat with them for, you know, maybe like 3-4 days, and then I'm like, hey, do you want to go on a date? And you were like, oh, I just say yes.
I have no object permanence, and honestly, if I'm just texting you for 4 days, I will eventually stop answering because I haven't met you yet, and then it'll fizzle out. Okay, part of the problem is me, but I definitely have seen it with other people for sure. I think it almost feels like dating is also, you know, in a world where people are like trying to kind of like maximize their lives. They're like, okay, I have to do my class pass yoga thing at 6, and then I have to do this at whatever, and then I have to squeeze this date in, and I just have to like have it all in a way that technology is making almost too easy for people who really want that. Like, you can definitely see the impacts of that.
I feel like dating's become a bit like a job interview.
Yes.
Like, since we've removed the entire recording process and we already know what the person is all about because we've seen their profile, it's like we've kind of read their job application and now it's about like honing down how they could benefit us, like what they can do for me. And I think it's just made it super selective. Like, okay, I was seeing this guy who we were out one night and this Blade song came on, like Bladey, and he was mouthing along to the lyrics and like he was like grabbing me and he was like trying to get me to sing along with him. And I don't listen to Blade, so I just kind of smiled at him, and I could see in his eyes in that moment he was like, she is not for me, because I was just not meeting that criteria. Like, and it was such a specific criteria, but I just felt like we ended things very soon after this, and I felt truly like that was part of it.
But that's so stupid. And you think that has to do with like the business mindset of it?
Well, I just think that in the way that we've gotten extremely selective about our criteria. Yeah. Like, we're like, oh, how can this person optimize me? How can I maximize their potential for me? You know what I mean? Like Jamie Woo says at one point, unlike sites like Match.com or OkCupid, there's no mention of compatibility tests. The solution isn't to raise the success rate, but to burn off bad fits and to replace them quickly with another possibility, which will become very prevalent down the line.
Yes.
And he describes Simkai's entire philosophy about dating as pragmatic, which is just, it's just giving I have an MBA in dating.
Yeah, definitely pragmatic, definitely like, sometimes I'm like, wow, I used to be a romantic and maybe I'm not a romantic anymore. And I'm like, no, our culture isn't romantic anymore. And I'm responding to that.
You were such a romantic in high school. And I think you still have it within you.
Well, I do think like my notions of love are romantic, but I've become cynical in an increasingly cynical dating atmosphere. Yes. I don't know.
And it's not you. It's not you. It's them.
Yeah, I'm perfect.
You're perfect. This one scholar also named Tom Roach actually describes Grindr's interface as looking like Andy Warhol's Campbell's soup cans piece, in that it's like these tiny squares of people, like tiny photos kind of all stacked on top of each other. Oh. That you scroll through, kind of like products on a shelf.
Like Instagram?
A little bit, but it's different people all flooded like into feed. One. But yeah, a feed kind of style. And he's basically pointing to this idea that it's a form of like self-commodification.
True.
Another big thing about Grindr is that partly because of the GPS technology, it became used primarily for casual sex, mm-hmm. like a hookup app. Do you think there are any other reasons why this may have happened specifically with Grindr, like something culturally?
Like why Grindr was the first one like this?
Like, no, like why Grindr so quickly became used for casual sex?
I think it might just have to do with the fact that there is a more of a wealth of options if you're a straight person and you want to like pick someone up at a bar, especially in areas where there aren't like specifically like a lot of designated queer bars, right? So if you're a gay man and you're like trying to find someone to hook up with, there's more utility in the existence of Grindr than say like later incarnations like Tinder, because you are already like limited for options. So I think it makes sense in that sense. And then also the GPS of it all, like knowing someone's proximity to you. Like
it's a quick thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that would be a feature that would inevitably be used in order to like find someone who is close by at that moment to meet up with.
Also, cruising has been a major aspect of the gay community for a long time. Gay men have historically been characterized, you know, especially during the AIDS crisis, as promiscuous, quote unquote. But a big reason for why cruising and casual sex are so prevalent in this community stems from the fact that, like, you know, homosexuality had been criminalized for so long, mm-hmm. which made it so that men had to seek intimacy clandestinely and, like, weren't afforded the opportunity to form long-term relationships. And this, of course, you know, it's not the only reason why this is the case, but that is a big part of it. I also spoke to my friend who uses Grindr, and he had some interesting insights as well. He said basically that anonymity is very important to the gay community still. You know, people are still coming out, they're still figuring themselves out, and that's a really important aspect. There's so many reasons why this kind of thing needs to be the case, and Grindr makes that a lot easier for them. He also said that in non-urban areas, like where there are less sex clubs, for example, less places for gay men to congregate and proposition each other, he said that Grindr fills the space of that now that public life has moved online. Mm-hmm. So it's also good for that.
It also would probably be safer because I think there's less opportunity for you to mistakenly think that somebody is gay.
Yeah.
Make an advance and then put yourself in potentially harm's way, right?
Totally. And then thinking about the AIDS crisis, he was talking about how it's also easier maybe because there's this whole culture of negotiation, right? Like AIDS made it so that you kind of have to talk about STIs right on the get-go. And he said that because AIDS happened and then like the internet happened so soon after, like something like Grindr makes this negotiation easier. Like it's easier to ask someone about HIV instead of having to do it while you're already hooking up. Like you do it beforehand.
Right.
And it's easier than asking them in person. And he also made an interesting point. He was kind of thinking about maybe that, and this is not like verified, but there was kind of an end to the gayberhood, as he calls it. Like a lot of gay villages, which put men in proximity to each other. And he was saying that this kind of creates a new like digital gayberhood in a way.
And then if you live in a city without one or like a more rural area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and like the biggest demographic of users of Grindr, at least when it began, was in urban centers. But still, I'm sure that now its popularity has flooded into other areas.
Interesting.
He also talks about how it was like easier. It made rejection a bit easier, you know, which I think is the case with most dating apps in general. But because of this casual sex element, Grindr got quite a lot of criticism early on from people in the community for substituting emotional connection and intimacy with what Wu calls physical gratification. Hmm. He says that a lot of these people were people who were already kind of critical of cruising in general. But essentially the idea is here that people believed that Grindr made sex convenient, and the more accessible the sex and more choices of sexual partners, the less long-term connections would be made. Simkai then made a straight version of Grindr in 2011 called Blender.
Blender?
Blender.
Wait, why is it called?
Because he's blending the genders.
Wait, I love that. So funny. That's what they should call straight relationships, blended relationships.
Blended relationships. That's so funny. But Blender was a bit of a misfire because when it was announced, tons of people, especially women, came out and were like, you could never make a straight Grindr. It would never work. Why do you think they thought that?
Well, we have a lot of preconceived notions about women and casual sex. And like, I don't have the data to back up what is true or what is false, but we do have a preconceived notion about like women's willingness to like participate in like hookup culture, especially so openly where you're making an account and like actively seeking it out.
Yeah, totally. I think that's definitely one aspect of it is this kind of essentialist presumption that women don't want casual sex, wouldn't want to seek it out. The other side of it was that people thought that women wouldn't want to seek it out because it was dangerous.
But I feel like there's definitely like risk with Grindr as well.
There are massive risks for gay men cruising. Like, of course. But yeah, there's this article for The New Yorker by Anne Friedman where she talks about how Grindr has this like for us, by us element to it that straight dating sites don't. Like all the other straight dating sites at the time, she was saying, were created by men. Mm-hmm. And then she says, sure, they can try to focus group their way out of the problem. But if an app for straight people is to get anywhere close to Grindr's level of success, women have to not just join out of curiosity, they have to actually use it. Which, again, a little essentialist, but I understand the fears.
Yeah. I think especially with dating apps when they're very new and stuff, I think safety is like a major concern. And like, it's not like people had established the kinds of rules or like approaches to things that would help them feel more comfortable and more safe about it.
Yeah. And I think stranger danger was also a bigger thing around this time.
Yeah. Meeting a stranger off the internet is scary and risky.
Yeah, totally. So everyone was going on about how there could never be a Grindr for straight people. But then came Tinder.
Damn, I really wish that it was Blender, though. I really wish that we called it Blender.
And you can kind of see how Tinder is the name playing off of that.
Yes, absolutely.
Tinder launched in 2012 as a startup experiment, and it was predicated on this idea that people were more likely to approach someone if they know that a person is also into them. So they revolutionized this concept of a swipe function, where unlike Grindr's like Campbell's Soup Can, the interface is designed like a deck of cards, so you're not seeing all the options at once. It's like one card pops up at the top of the deck, then you have to swipe left if you're not into them, or right if you are. It also features like a small series of photos, a bio, and certain dating preferences, which they also had on Grindr, like the gender of your matches, geographical distance, age range, what have you. Mm-hmm. Tinder was wildly successful pretty much from the jump. By 2014, Tinder users were swiping a combined total of a billion times a day.
Jesus.
Yeah. And as of 2022, it's been downloaded over 530 million times.
What?
Crazy.
That is crazy.
Do you remember your first experience with Tinder? Like how you felt about it when you first downloaded it or heard about it?
Yeah. Well, I remember I had first heard about it in high school. Like I think I was in grade 12 and a couple people I knew. Because I don't know if that still exists, but they used to have it. So, like, if you were under 18, you could still get Tinder, but you were only seeing other people under 18. Like, mm-hmm. there were, I don't know if it's still like that, but.
Under 18?
Yeah. Like, 17-year-olds, you could, but you just wouldn't see people over.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I remember this. And so I knew people who had Tinder. And then I got it my first year of university when I was 18. And I remember the first time I got it, I was swiping through and then I saw my ex-boyfriend from high school on there and I was like, I'm so embarrassed. I'm deleting this right now.
No.
And then I think I downloaded it again like immediately after. And I remember being more into it when I first got it. Like, I'm going to embarrass us both maybe, but there was a time in university that I went to my Yia's apartment and we literally sat side by side on her bed, swiped on Tinder for hours. Like, I don't think we did anything else.
It was fun. Like, it was a novelty thing.
It was so new and it was so exciting. And I was 18 and I was like, wow, dating. And I, you know, I had a crush on a boy from one of my classes and we ended up talking on Tinder and like I was seeing him for like a short window of time and that was really exciting for me. So I think when I first got Tinder and you kind of get past the embarrassment of like, I'm on Tinder, then it was kind of fun and exciting, especially at that age.
Oh, totally. It's so fun. My roommate's favorite pastime at the time was to go on my phone and get rid of all my preferences and then just swipe right on every single person she saw just to see how many matches I got. Yeah, I was 18 also when I got Tinder and I remember also finding it really exciting at first. The main reason I thought it was exciting was because there were people kind of in the city or in the scene that I thought were cute, but I felt were kind of too cool to approach, for example. Mm-hmm. But the app kind of forces you to think about someone that you wouldn't think of in like a romantic or sexual light, who like maybe if you saw each other passing on the street, you wouldn't think of them that way. But because you're forced into this thing where you're both looking at each other through a dating app, you're going to be like, oh, and then consider that person in this light. So I ended up kind of like matching with these people and then going out with them. So it kind of made you gain access to each other in a way that you may otherwise not have.
Yeah, it like broke down a boundary. Like I was too shy to talk to the boy in my class, but
exactly.
We talked on Tinder.
Exactly. And also, I just think for us specifically at that age, like once you're out of high school and you're not just around people all the time and like you can talk to them at any time, it's harder to meet people.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, most of the people I met up with from the earlier years were people I knew of already. So I never felt that risk because I already kind of knew who they were. They had social medias that I could go check mm-hmm. and like they were linked to their profiles. So it wasn't too scary. So there's a study from 2017 which presents a very positive image of Tinder. They coined this term networked intimacy and basically say that it's, quote, about flirting, courtship, and the ongoing search for love and fulfillment via dating apps and smartphones. Networked intimacy brings new freedoms, opportunities, and pleasures, as well as old and new anxieties about risk, self-image, and love. And not to be a downer, but we will see why this was actually a bit too utopian.
Well, the way I shuddered when you read networked intimacy. Kill me now.
Yeah, I wasn't the biggest fan of this study.
So
today, there are a whole number of smartphone dating apps, some of which we will cover in this episode. But Tinder specifically is known as the hookup app these days. The place you don't go if you want to actually meet someone and connect with them. It's a place you go for casual sex. I've always found this interesting. Why do you think that it has this reputation these days?
See, I thought it kind of always had that reputation a little bit, especially when other apps popped up. They really marketed themselves on, like, we're for dating because we already know that Tinder's for hookups. I think that was always kind of the way that I thought it was seen culturally. I think because it was the first kind of mainstream alternative to traditional dating websites and online dating, which were so
for heterosexual partners.
Yes, for heterosexuals, which were so based in the idea of like matchmaking, where it's like Tinder, you're not having to meet different qualifications or like show that much about yourself. There's a lack of intimacy with Tinder that just made that make sense. Personally, like, I don't actually think of it that way fully. Like, I think, yes, there's probably more people on there to just hook up, but I also think there are a lot of people who just use it to date.
A lot of us just have multiple of the apps and we're like, oh, well, let's see who I can get based on, like, you're widening your possibilities, basically.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people do date through Tinder, or at least, like, I don't know, I haven't really thought about it as much that way, but I know that that's the cultural perception of it.
I've always found it kind of fascinating because, like, I've met up with people on there who are similar people that I would have met up with on other apps, so it's interesting. But I do think, just in the research, I do think Tinder best embodies a lot of the issues we're having today with the attention economy.
Mm-hmm.
It features like a very, very wide, like you're saying, uncurated breadth of selections. It only allows you, you know, so many pictures to display, so many characters in your bio, and like the ease of swiping through this like endless pool of people and the whole deck of card things and the excitement of matching with someone has actually been likened by a lot of scholars to gambling.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
Yeah, and so as Cole explains in her book, Tinder gives users a dopamine hit by gamifying dating, which is something that you had brought up to me when we were talking about this episode. And I don't know, this fast satisfaction that you get from matching with someone makes you want to keep swiping because you're like, let's see how many more I can do.
Well, yeah, this is the thing about these dating apps is like, I'll match with people. I'm like, oh, they're cute. Yes, whatever. And then they get lost in everything because you're like, well, I'm going to keep swiping. And then you have this person that maybe you could have connected with, but no one's like talked to each other because they're both just on the app so much. It's like you're almost just there to get the gratification, that someone else thinks you're attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move on and it's like you're not really achieving what I assume your goals are for being on there in the first place.
Totally.
I don't like the way it kind of forces you to boil down someone's entire essence into like how they've chosen to present themselves on a profile.
Oh yeah, especially with guys, the photos that they post, I judge them so heavily based on the type of photo it is.
But it's like, I know my close male friends and they have like 5 photos of themselves from the last 4 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, they're probably limited in pictures to include. The pictures always seem kind of dated. And then, I don't know, it's like trying to write a bio, you're like, am I going to be funny? Am I going to be earnest? And then you're judging someone else on that too.
Like, I am never earnest.
I'm never earnest either, but I'm also like...
And I'm icked out by earnestness. When people are earnest on the apps, I'm immediately like, no, and maybe that's bad.
I think it is bad because I always think about how like a lot of the people that I've been interested in that I've met in real life are people I may very well not have like swiped right for on an app because I think of the ways that our brains are then trained to like filter out certain things.
Oh yeah. If I like I've whatever met people on chance encounters, let's say on like vacation or something, and they'll try to ask me for my Instagram and I never want it because I don't want to see their social media profile because I know I'm going to be judgmental about it.
Yeah.
Like it's just I don't need to know what their social media profile is. I already like you in real life, you know?
Yeah. And I just again, like I'm just a deep believer in like chemistry and in just you can feel when you're hitting it off with someone. And when your first step of dating is weeding people out based solely on looks and not on like that kind of connection, it's just I think it's gonna be harder to find someone you actually like.
To be completely honest, like the people I've had the best experiences with in my dating life are people that I wouldn't typically go for based on their profiles, like people who I've kind of gone out of the box with. And the people that I've dated that are like my type on paper have fucking sucked. So it's truly like, yeah, it's a really flawed science, I think.
Yeah.
And I think with all this choice comes a bit of fatigue. There's this anthropologist named Helen Fisher who found that people experience cognitive overload when there are more than 9 options in front of them. Another study published in the Journal of Psychological Science in the Public Interest also cited this idea of being cognitively overwhelmed. And they concluded that to cope with this feeling, you objectify the people you're seeing on your screen. Oh, again, with that idea of like commodification.
Definitely.
Yeah. So your brain is turning people into objects for consumption, like we're doing when I'm like, oh, your photo has a film grain on it. It was taken with a film camera. Oh, yes. Like it's turning someone into a camera.
Oh, totally.
You know?
And it makes me think about online shopping a little bit, where it's like you could spend hours online shopping trying to find like the perfect thing or whatever. And then honestly, in the end, I still can't decide and not buy anything. It's not worth the investment. But if you go to like a store, like a vintage store or a thrift store, and you might stumble upon something and you're like, this is my favorite thing in this store. And it's actually great. And it's something you wear or use all the time.
And this experience you have with like touching the object and being with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like, yeah. I think it's similar to that where it's like, yeah, if I know, I don't want to make the wrong choice when I know I have so many choices. But when I'm actually kind of limited to these smaller choices, that makes it sound like you're like, oh, I'm without choice with dating. But I just mean like when you have a smaller pool and you're kind of just engaging with things in person, you might actually find something. Whereas like, I don't think you're going to find anything if you keep just shopping around.
Again, with the issue with screening with Jeffrey Ullman, like it's going to be more superficial.
Yeah.
They also say the apps become really routinized. Similar to the way we were talking about OnlyFans at the end of last episode, it becomes amalgamated into the daily processes of scrolling through like Instagram or Twitter rather than, you know, a special intentional moment of romantic selection. Totally. Like, I think for us, in how late a stage we are in dating apps, like, it takes a lot of effort. But I think back in the day, it's like, okay, like, sometimes we'll both be watching a TV show and we're just swiping aimlessly on these apps. Yeah, I just feel like, being completely candid, like, almost every early experience I had with Tinder led either to casual sex or like very short-term relationships, regardless of whether I wanted that. And that was a very early experience for me. I was only 18. And like, of course, this may be a symptom of how old we all were and like the people I was seeing were, but I also felt like when guys first got the app back then, they were going absolutely crazy with this newfound ability to hook up with people, like as many girls as possible. Like most of the guys I was seeing were also seeing like 5 other women. And it was hard to grapple with because I hadn't really experienced that before. I had been in high school before, but still.
Well, yeah, no, but I think that like we as a species wasn't really grappling with that before.
Yeah, like obviously they're womanizing or just like being, I don't know, promiscuous in general has always been a thing, and good power to you.
But
like
that
the sexual
takes work.
Basically what I want to ask is, do you think Tinder kind of killed Riz a bit?
I was about to say, yes, absolutely. I think so. Because like, I think I would get really cringy if someone was being too charming or flirty or whatever on an app too.
Oh, when they use pickup lines? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, okay, we've been watching Love Island All-Stars.
Shocker.
It was bad. And there's a guy on it named Toby who is quite literally the dumbest person I've ever seen in
like
my life.
A brick.
Absolute brick. And mean. Like, mean to women.
Personally, I don't find him that hot either. I don't get it.
Yes. But all of the women on the show go cuckoo for him. And my kind of conclusion is that he must have an innate thing about him that you can only experience in person.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, it's not translating through a screen.
Some pheromone being released from his body.
Something, right? And I think that it's similar to this where I don't really think that you are forced to like develop game or like flirting or Riz when you can just find someone on an app. And I also think that a lot of people who might have those things aren't able to showcase them.
Oh, the amount of times, like especially back then, where I'd be out and I'd see some guy and like we'd make eye contact, but then that's the end of it. Or they wouldn't even make eye contact with me, but I know who they were and they were at the thing, and then get a DM or like a message on a dating app later being like, hey, saw you out tonight. And it's like, ew, just fucking talk to me. Yeah. Like, I genuinely feel like people are so Rizless these days. I think I'm probably Rizless. I went up to a guy last year and I said to him, you booed up.
It was hilarious. Okay, this was the end of the night. She was not sober and I was proud of her.
Yeah, then he said yes and I went, right, okay. And then I physically ran in the opposite direction out of the apartment. No, I think sometimes I do have Riz. I think I can be charming.
I think you could have Riz.
I think I can be flirty. I do find that people, especially in Toronto, where I think North Americans lack charisma in general.
Yeah.
Oh, there
we
is
really
no
do.
Riz.
Actually, like, literally talking to people from other countries where Riz feels more culturally of a thing. I feel like such a boring, lame Canadian.
Oh, like, my God. Going to Europe and how easy it is to meet people in person there yeah. is insane, because the people there are so much better at just talking to you.
And, like, yeah, I'm a very, very shy person. And so
I think you are very charismatic, though, when you're feeling yourself.
When I'm feeling myself and when I've had a little bit to drink, I'm very...
Hannah negs. She negs.
I am a flirty drunk.
She'll be a little mean to you.
But, like, I have always, before social media existed, been someone that, like, I feel very shy and uncomfortable going up to people and talking to people. And, like... Well,
in real life, rejection is... a little bit more awkward, right? Other people witness it half the time.
Yeah, but even just, like, socially, like, I'm a shy person, whatever. And so, like, I can see how these dating apps are, like, too beneficial for people like me, where it's, like, I don't think that the conclusion should be, like, oh, it's fine that I'm this shy and that I have a harder time meeting new people in person. I think the option should be that you put yourself out there and you kind of grow and, yeah. and get better. And I think...
Shooting your shot on a dating app sometimes feels like giving up.
Oh my God, yeah. And it's also like, I think the impact is just so minimized by it. Like, it's just not the same as being asked out in person or being asked out by somebody you've gotten to know in person.
Yeah, totally. I completely agree.
Yes. And I don't know. I think it's also just made people afraid of dating culture. Dating apps have made people afraid of just like showing interest in each other in person, and also afraid of other people showing interest in you, and like not in a creepy way, just in like a
And also sometimes in a creepy way. Like, I think sometimes people mistake forwardness for something more insidious, and I think that that's strange too.
Yeah,
you know,
and it almost feels like at this point, if you are someone who's like still kind of forward with other people in person, it says something negative about you inherently, even if that's not actually the case.
Totally.
Like, I just feel like we immediately are like, have our guards up and are like, why are you talking to me like this? Like, why are you trying to show that you like me?
Totally. I had this whole thing with my friend where he goes to bars all the time and reads alone, like at the bar. He was like, why don't you do that more often? Because I had just gotten to New York and I was doing things more on my own. I'm trying to put myself out there by doing that. And I was like, okay, I'll go try it, but I'm going to guarantee you someone comes up to me and tries to talk to me. Like, I can't just exist in a public space. And so I went to a bar and read. And within 20 minutes, a guy at the bar slid over and was like, what are you reading? And I was so annoyed. But then I talked to my friend about it again. And he was like, okay, well, if he was hot, wouldn't you have been happy? And I was like, oh, honestly, true. Like, I thought I was creepy. And like, yes, let women exist in public spaces. Do not approach women at the gym, you freaks. But that could have been a meet cute had I been into him.
Yeah.
You know? And I think just treating that as an inherently creepy, annoying thing is like maybe sometimes not fair. I also want to be able to go up to a guy in public and be like, you're cute.
Oh, yeah. Like, whenever someone does go up to me in person now, it's always in, like, actually weird ways where I'm like, okay, so these are the only people left that are willing to put themselves out there.
That's the thing. The last forward men standing are the ones that I absolutely don't want talking to.
I got stopped in the street by a man, and when I react kind of like, huh, he was like, huh, you scared me. And I was like, you are coming up to me. And then he was like, do you have a boyfriend? And I was like...
One time I was walking on the street and I was wearing this like really big long dress, but it was kind of like the skirt kind of poofed out, and the wind hit, blew my skirt up all the way above my head. And so I was like obviously embarrassed because I'm in public, and this guy came up to me not 3 seconds after, walked up to me and said, hey, do you know where the nearest Starbucks is? And I was like, God. Yeah. And then in the middle of me saying yes, he went, and also, do you have a boyfriend? Do you want to go on a date? And I was like, you cannot ask me out after this just happened.
That is so funny. And also, the fake I need directions move is so annoying.
And also, let someone answer.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. He's practicing.
He's practicing. And you know what? Kudos to him, I guess. Anyways, this is not free reign to be creepy.
No, don't be creepy. Don't become a pickup artist. Just, like, learn to talk to women and don't see them... Like, just see a woman as a normal person.
Yeah, and then have Riz if you are interested in them. Like, do it in a way that's charismatic and not gross and creepy.
Or just, like, like, you can just be normal. If you don't have an innate charisma, be normal. I think in those situations where people are going up to you in person and in the situations of, like, online dating, it's just, like, really thinking of women or, like, just people to date in general as things to, like, have. It's like an achievement. You're, like... Pokemon, collecting them all or whatever. And it's like, or you like just like allow yourself to have a connection with somebody and then talk to them based off of that.
Yeah, if I'm going to be asked out on the street, I want our conversation to happen kind of organically and to have a slight conversation before that even happens. Like, I don't want someone to walk up to me and say, hey, you're cute, want to go on a date. Like, maybe. I need to be courted a bit.
Or we could like share eye contact first that shows interest.
I had one day a few months ago where I was walking around the city with my friend and I was rizzing with my eyes. I don't know what happened, but about 8 different men flirted with me in the span of like an hour. And my friend was like, what is up? Like, she noticed it. She was like, what is up with you? I don't think I was looking particularly good. I don't know what was going on. I was releasing some sort of pheromone into the air, but I was rizzing people with my eyes. I was really...
Oh, yeah. That's me on vacation.
I was really blinking heavily.
Yeah.
That's me as a baby.
That's me as a baby.
So there's this whole idea that by building dopamine hits into their app, Tinder makes it so that you're always wanting more, mm-hmm. which is why when Hinge blew up in 2019, it kind of made a lot of sense. Basically, Hinge is modeled on this idea that it's designed to be deleted.
Yes.
As opposed to Tinder, Hinge is positioned as the app that'll get you that long-term partner that you've been looking for. So it was founded by Justin McLeod, who had originally founded this desktop service called Secret Agent Cupid, where people could make lists of their crushes. And you can see how this inspired Hinge, because unlike Tinder, where like if you swipe left on someone, you're never going to know that they swiped on you. Like there's a bit more anonymity in the rejection.
Sure.
Hinge shows you who liked you, like who's crushing on you, basically. And it's extremely popular today. Would you say it's like the main app you use?
I guess. Well, it's the main app I would like to use, but again, I'm really not using the apps. I have them on my phone. Am I doing enough with them? No, but...
Was it at one point the main app you were using?
No.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, back to being, like, really shy. And this is the problem, is that, like, Tinder kind of allows you to be more coy about it, whereas like Hinge is kind of a bit more forward, and I should not be allowing Tinder to enable me, but it has like my shyness, I guess. But I think it's a really popular one for most of the people we know. I know some beautiful couples who have met on Hinge.
Yeah, there are some great couples from there.
Like some
from
of,
there.
Well, some of our very good friends found like the perfect person on Hinge.
Totally, totally. Agreed. It was for a while the main app I was using. I sometimes would use Tinder. Every once in a while, I'll like re-download Raya and then I'm like, this is terrible, and I delete it again. But the thing is, though, either Hinge came too late or something else is at play. Because even with the supposed promise of romance, and, you know, we have these outliers that we know, these couples that are great. But even with this promise, even with these exceptions, it seems like we're in a greater romance and intimacy crisis than ever before.
I believe it.
I will be completely honest. Casual sex is already hard enough to come by these days, let alone romance. There is nothing happening here. There is no sex. There is no romance. Something's going on. We talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
There was all this buzz in the earlier years of Tinder around hookup culture. Like, it really brought this concept of hookup culture to the fore, and there was a bit of a panic about it.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said at the beginning of this episode, young people are actually having less sex than previous generations. Basically, there were a few studies that came out around the same time in 2021 from UCLA, the University of Chicago, and San Diego State, which found that people around the age 18 to 30 range were reporting less sexual partners than their older counterparts had reported at that same age, and were going longer periods without having sex. But on the opposite side of casual sex, long-term relationships also seem to be waning as well. Like, there's that entire discussion on TikTok among, like, millions of people, especially women, complaining about situationships and how they keep getting into these things and they can't get someone to just commit to them long term. It really feels today like people treat a relationship like marriage.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like the ultimate commitment to get someone to want to date you.
I know. And it's like, okay, the beauty about dating in high school was that, like, a long-term relationship was 8 months. You're like, we've been together for too long. I actually need to spread my wings and be free. We've been together for 8 months. And then you date more people, which that was different. Life was different when we were teenagers. But I just mean that, like, why is it in adulthood that we, like, can't keep that mindset? It's okay to date someone for less than a year and still be committed to them and date them. I don't know.
Yeah, I had this whole thing when I first started dating called Seinfeld dating, was that it's like on these sitcoms, they have this slightly unrealistic thing where every episode Jerry's been dating someone for like a month or 2 months at a time and then dumps them, and like that's his short-term relationship. But it even feels hard to get someone to commit to 1 or 2 months of dating.
I also think a lot of like, this is kind of a great bigger thing, but like I think a lot of really great art is about short-term romances. And not that like I want everyone to be walking around with their like hearts broken and stuff, but I think that,
yeah, but heartbreaks are honestly good for the soul. Like, you learn something.
And I think maybe what if we as a generation end up suffering artistically because not enough people are having passionate like whirlwind affairs, you know?
Hey, that's honestly a good theory.
I don't know. I think I said I would never talk about her again, but I think you look at Taylor Swift's dating records and a lot of the men she was dating was like for like 2 months or something. I think,
Eve Babbitt's?
Yeah.
Eve Babbitt's whole career is based off of this.
But it's like those are those things that like never get the chance to fizzle out or whatever, or are just like happening fast, I think inspire art. But they also, like, I think end up meaning a lot to us in our lifetimes because there's just so much emotion there. And because you didn't kind of like live to see something die, and there's not the same closure. And I know that that can be a bad thing. It can be a sad thing. But I also think that like
sadness is important. Like, I think it's important to be sad in your life.
And I think that the emotion that you feel in that time like makes it worth it. It's like part of like knowing you're alive.
Oh, totally. I'm writing about this right now. It's a hugely important thing. And I think trying to save ourselves from those emotions is really lame.
I talk to a lot of like single girls I know, and it's kind of like people who are so different from one another and like who bring different things to the table are all kind of ending up in the same situation in a way that makes me feel like it's a cultural thing. It's not really an individual thing.
No, I think, yeah, I think it's something we're all experiencing simultaneously, and it's really horrible. I wish I had known this before getting out of a long-term relationship. I wish I had been forewarned.
I kind of feel like, I don't know, since the pandemic, we've all been kind of like zombies. I feel like there's a lot of sleepwalking through life, and we're afraid of the things that like disrupt that like disrupt a kind of safe balance that we like to feel. And I don't know, maybe that's also a symptom of being in your mid-20s and having like likely gone through your first major heartbreak. There's a reluctancy to want to subject yourself to that kind of pain again. But I think, you know, if I've learned anything from my own experiences, it's that turning away feelings, turning away negative emotions is in the long run like a really bad thing. I don't know. I think I mark periods of my life by like the highs and lows that I experience. And if I'm not putting myself out there enough to experience either of those things, then I feel like I've like kind of lost those years. And that's what a lot of my mid-20s were feeling like a bit, especially totally. Because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
This is getting more existential, but I just think that like dating apps and the current dating culture are really contributing to that. I think we're all very scared, and I understand there's reasons that we're scared, but the best way to deal with it is to kind of work against it.
I completely agree with you. I'm currently in a phase where I'm not dating anyone, and I don't like it. Like, I'm in a phase where everything's peaceful, and I've seen all these TikToks about this. Like, I'm like, whoa, I'm at peace when I'm not crying about some person. But it's boring. Like, the past few months have just flown by. And not to make everything about dating, a lot of awesome things have happened in my life as well. But, like, it's so at an emotional equilibrium that my life is boring.
Well, then I also think, like, it's important to know how to be alone. And I think that everyone should have a period where they're alone. I feel very okay being alone now in my life.
Totally.
But I'm like, okay. And then it gets to a point where I think there are just certain things that you can't feel outside of, like, romantic situation with somebody, and like there are just certain emotions that you're kind of closed off to, and like they're fun things to feel, and like you want to feel them again. I don't know.
Yeah, I've had very little highs, like very high highs. Maybe I place those highs too much into romance, but I don't see how there's anything really wrong with that. Like, I think also these past few years of, especially from the 2010s, of downplaying the importance of romantic love has kind of harmed us a bit. Like, I do think romantic love is important if you want it, and like I think it's okay to prioritize it. I think it's okay to want love, and I think this movement to say otherwise isn't very fair. So, you know, we've covered some of the pretty obvious factors that go into this intimacy crisis, but how do you think dating apps specifically fit into it? Like, how do you think they've triggered this intimacy crisis?
Well, because it's taken the intimacy out of dating.
Totally.
Like, I'm sorry, I don't feel things for a picture on a screen. And I don't believe anybody who says that they do. Like, you can maybe once you've started engaging and talking with someone, you can feel connection, but there's nothing intimate or vulnerable or kind of anything about. I know I said that I felt vulnerable on Hinge, like putting myself out there, but like not in the same way.
Yeah.
Like it's just, yeah. I think they've contributed to it because not only is the courting process less intimate, but there's kind of like a pre-setup notion that the actual interaction itself will be less intimate.
Totally.
Because of the kind of casualness that is associated with online dating.
Yeah, I hate when you just both know what's going to happen. It's made first dates so boring too, because you're like, yeah, we're on a first date. I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah. And that would be fine if there was kind of like a balanced option. Like you could go on these if you're trying to just hook up with somebody, but you know, people are still trying to date and meet each other in person. But because that has died down so much, it's like your only option is the more casual thing.
Exactly, exactly. There's this theory by a philosopher named Zygmunt Bauman called liquid love, where he says that like the hyper-individualism and like other elements of late capitalist culture essentially like liquefy human bonds. Whoa. So that goes for like familial, friendship, and romantic bonds. Like we're losing these structures.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really kind of encompasses a problem here. I think dating apps create like a very negative feedback loop for human connection. Like, going as far back as Great Expectations, these companies have operated within this capitalist marketplace, which has gotten more and more competitive as the years go on. And, you know, capitalism is all about finding a gap in the market or some sort of thing that society is lacking. And the whole thing to get ahead in it is that you're going to promise people that your product can fill that gap, right? Fulfill that need. So with Grindr and Tinder, it's like accessibility that they're fulfilling. With Bumble, it's this idea that like men are the first to initiate and it's giving women the chance to do that. And with Hinge, it's that like everyone is too into casual sex these days and addicted to their apps. So like we'll be okay if you delete your app and we want you to meet someone long term. But it's all basically the same thing because yeah. It's all just trying to gain a competitive edge. And ultimately, like, I really feel that the more lonely and single we all are, the longer these apps will survive.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Sad singles are their lifeblood. And if we all start attempting to like meet organically and start long-term partnerships, there's no reason for them to exist anymore.
Well, also, whenever Hinge being like the app that's meant to be deleted, from the beginning, I've been like, bull fucking shit. No way are you as like a business trying to make it so that your product is something that people are supposed to have like a time limit for. No way. Where would you get your money from? I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah.
And it's like obviously marketing.
Of course it's marketing. Samantha Cole says, my girl, she says, it's possible that constant innovation and disruption on something so fundamentally human is actually making it worse, which I think she hits the nail on the head. I don't know. I always love to say this idea that I talk about all the time, but I just feel like capitalism erodes human connection and then sells you things to make you feel more human.
Well, yes.
And I think that's exactly what these apps are. Like, they're flirting apps. There's a thing called Bumble BFF, which I think is it's nice in theory, but so depressing. Because they're just capitalizing on our alienation from each other.
Yeah.
No. And we're never going to get better at making friends if we are relying on apps.
Yeah, and I think we live in a city where people are closed off. Right, on a friendship level, on a romantic level.
The vibes here are awful.
Awful, and just, like, in person, like, people aren't open to, like, necessarily meeting new people or letting new people into their lives a lot unless there's some kind of, like, clear benefit from those relationships with other people. So I understand on, like, a theoretical level, like, wanting to kind of be able to locate the people who are also looking to make new friends or start relationships, having those places where you can just find them instead of floating aimlessly through the city. But then I think that it's just kind of like harshening the boundaries between the two things.
Yeah, it's a negative feedback loop. Like one creates the other.
Yeah.
Creates the other.
Yeah. Where I don't know. I don't know if it's like helped as much. And I don't know. I don't know what the people on Bumble BFF are like saying, and maybe they've had great results. I'm sure if you're new to the city, dating apps are a good way to meet new people. But especially where we live, like, and maybe North America generally, there's just like such a cold culture.
Do you think that there's any way, any world where an app could actually encourage more organic intimacy and like nurture intimacy in long-term relationships?
No. And, like, there are people who have intimate relationships with people that they meet online, obviously. And there are people who have, like, kind of long-distance intimate relationships with strangers through the internet. And I'm not invalidating those experiences, but I think on, like, a systemic level, no.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've already kind of seen the test pilots of different apps that are trying maybe to cultivate that, and it doesn't really work.
No.
And also, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Like, I really do just want to meet people in person.
Yeah.
Personally, and, like,
it feels more rewarding. I don't know.
And also, like, I don't know. Like, I don't really think of myself as, like, having a type so much as, like, but I'm not on a dating app looking for specific things.
No, no, no.
And I really think that, like, I respond to, like, somebody's energy and personality, like, so much more than I do to, like, looks. And I don't like thinking of people that way. And I don't like thinking of myself that way as being, like, something that's represented by these pictures or whatever.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't want that. Like, I think that's weird. Like, I think it's sad. I think it's fine. I'm so happy for the people that have met people on dating apps, but, like,
totally.
It's not really the future I want for myself.
Well, I just don't think we should need to have to rely on them.
No.
And I think that's the main problem. So, coming to the end here, I want to slightly pivot. I just want to go back to that Friedman article where she talks about, you know, how, like, women wouldn't want a straight grinder. Because in it, she's like, it's likely to stay that way until a startup comes along that manages to make mobile dating not weird by offering women and the men they want to meet control, incredible filters, and clarity of mission. And I know you're probably thinking maybe that Bumble could fulfill this and, like, would be the answer to this problem she's posing. Bumble's basically founded by Whitney Wolf Hurd, who was VP of marketing at Tinder, but she left Tinder due to a sexual harassment case. She sued them for sexual harassment. And like I said, Bumble is founded on this concept of women being the ones who are allowed to message first in heterosexual matches. But since Bumble also pushes this idea of romance over casual sex, I actually want to argue that Field is the answer to Friedman's vision.
Is this a pro-Field advocacy?
No. Like I said, the straight grinder won't work. People presume that women don't want casual sex. But most of the information I got about Field was from this New Yorker article by a 39-year-old writer named Emily Witt, where she talks about how Field satisfied her interest in sexual experimentation after feeling listless and alienated during the pandemic. Field was founded by this guy named, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Dimo Trifonov in 2014 after his wife expressed to him that she was in love with another woman. Whoa. So basically it was an app created for threesomes. They stay together.
Wow.
But because, it's kind of nice, but yeah. Because of the very wide array of gender identifications it offers, it also became really popular in queer communities, yeah. Particularly among trans and non-binary people.
I hear it's more popular in Europe.
That checks out. But Witt also says it's big with, quote, married couples trying to spice up their lives, hardcore BDSM enthusiasts, and digisexuals who prefer their erotic contact with others mediated by a screen. This is mainly because it does a similar thing to Grindr where it lets you put in super, super specific sexual desires. Like, on fields, you can choose kink, group play, submission, butts, shibari, which is like Japanese rope bondage, among a ton of others. So Field, it is a really good, safe, and non-judgmental place for sexual experimentation, and Witt describes it as a place to be yourself or play at being someone else. Because of this, she describes it as the grown-up hookup app, because people on there largely aren't closed off to, or, like, immature about fringe sexuality, and even sex in general in the way that they would be on, like, a more traditional dating app. We both know people who use Field as their app of choice these days. Would you say Field could be the answer to the intimacy crisis?
No. I don't, again, like, personally, I don't think a dating app is going to be the answer to any kind of a crisis. I think having a lot of niche dating apps is at least beneficial for people wanting to maybe meet someone closer to what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's cool that that exists. I don't think that any place where you're kind of just breaking yourself and your, like, dating goals down into, like, what fits in, like, a questionnaire, basically, is, like, going to make things more intimate or more romantic.
Yeah.
I think it, at the end of the day,
like you said earlier, like dating feels like looking for a job.
Yeah.
And I think it's cool to maybe get closer to a job that is the type of job you want.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it's not the same.
It's not the same. I agree. I think that's the entire thing that holds it back beyond the filling this need thing. Witt says that the aim of self-representation on Field is to describe a sexual desire in language that won't repel the kind of person you'd like to meet. But going back to our Campbell's soup, like, self-commodification discussion, I think there's a bit of an issue, again, like you're saying, with self-branding that these, like, hyper-specific apps require. Not in terms of gender, obviously, but in terms of sexual interests. Like, in this conference paper by Dakota Hansen called Swipe, Fuck, Ghost, Repeat, How Dating Apps Change the Way We Form Relationships and View Intimacy, she talks about how dating apps heighten this idea of the self. Like, she's like, online dating and now dating apps have materialized the building of intimacy through their platforms, breaking down the self into discrete categories of taste, opinion, personality, and temperament based on answers provided to sign-up questions. Like you're saying, this questionnaire-based dating. And she says this leads to a skewed sense of self because of these self-branding techniques.
Totally.
And that captures exactly my thoughts about this. Like, I do think it's really great that people want to explore and experiment and be sex positive. I think it's really nice that there's a place for that. But also, by labeling our sexual interests as, like, part of our identities or, like, our brands, I feel like often, and I know this can change depending on, like, you know, queer partnerships, there is, like, an importance to that. But I think just most generally, these apps are kind of misconstruing something very organic and intrinsic to intimacy. I think because these apps require you to, like, identify who you are based on these categorizations, it limits the fluidity of intimacy and, like, removes the element of eroticism. Like we said, a lot of eroticism we've talked about in the season stems from outside of the act of sex, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, also, interests change over time. They change within a partnership. They change between partners. Like, you will not be the same in bed as you are with another person.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know, we've had friends who've gone on Field dates and felt like they were being kind of like placed in a box or typecasted based on the interests of the other person that they were seeing. I personally, like, I don't use Field, but I've gone out with some people who use it a lot. And the people I've gone out with who are really, really into Field, I often find that they talk about sex in a really frank way that kind of kills its allure a bit. Like, I am very open about sex, but it's so far.
Is it kind of like the Paul Verhoeven effect?
Yeah, like, it's, like, a little too, well, I actually have a term for these people. I call them sex nerds. Like, people who are so sex positive that they treat sex like a science to the extent that it becomes really unsexy. And I think Field is kind of the app for that. Not for everyone, of course, but I do think there's some ways that it can be used for that. Like, getting so hyper-specific and, like, rigid in what you're willing to do, what you're able to do. That can be limiting.
Definitely. I mean, I am somebody that doesn't like to use a letterbox despite being a film nerd because I don't like thinking about how the films I watch or consume or like how I rate them or whatever speaks to me on like a social media profile kind of way. Like, it just too much for my head. And so the idea of like going on a dating app and like applying that to something like so much more serious, which is like, you know, what I'm looking for with somebody, I don't get it.
And I think we're focusing mostly when we say this on more heterosexual partnerships, because yes. I think it is different within the queer community. Like, Grindr also had these like very specific categorizations.
But I just think that like when we, like you're saying, when we start to think about the self so much and start trying to kind of define ourselves so intensely, I think that we end up like just limiting our potential for experiences. Like, if we're talking about Letterboxd, it's like, I like these kinds of movies, and you're cutting off like whole genres or like whatever eras of film. And then I think with this, it's like, I think when you're thinking so much about yourself and how you're represented online and like trying and defining yourself so much, like, I think it can have a negative impact on your ego, and I think it can become very rigid, and I think it can just like close you off to so many things in life. And this is an issue with social media as a whole, not just dating apps.
We've gotten so self-descriptive in a way that's like a yes. little much.
And like, I am 26 years old and I couldn't describe myself to you, being honest. Other people will tell you things about yourself, but I honestly feel like a mystery to myself in so many ways.
I contain multitudes.
I don't even mean it like that. I think it's just like, I feel like I'm always changing. I'm always shifting, and like things are just kind of moving with the wind. And I feel like the times where I've really tried to be like, this is my sense of style and this is my taste and this is that, or like times where I'm like especially lost and just need to feel some kind of stability and gravity. And I think that maybe we as a culture are lost, and so we need to feel like,
and again, we're not talking about gender, we're talking about sexual desire.
Oh yeah, we're not talking about gender or sexuality at all. I'm talking about just the ways that dating apps like force you to kind of curate and cultivate a almost self-brand on your profile.
Yeah.
Sorry, exactly. I moved away from talking about that a bit.
Yeah, and I think that is yet another way to kind of dampen intimacy. Like, you're going on a date with someone and you already know what they want in bed, and you're like, okay, well, there's no surprise.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes obviously surprises are negative, but there is a good surprise also to hooking up with someone and learning something about them when that happens.
You can't predict the future and you can't control every event in your life. And like, I think you should just have an open mind to like organic experiences and impulsivity.
Yeah.
People are not impulsive enough anymore.
Go outside, run down the street, buy yourself an ice cream in winter and
seize the day.
Seize the day. To end off, I'm curious, do you see any way that we can restore real life connection?
Move to Europe, I guess.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.